Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And this week we have a very special episode because we have just recently completed the campaign for Betrayal Legacy.
Yes.
And so we're bringing you an extra special end of February spooky episode where we will give our concluding thoughts on Betrayal Legacy.
Right. Yeah. Because if you are unfamiliar with what Legacy means, it is a game that is played over multiple sessions in which decisions made during games permanently affect the copy of the game as a whole. Mm-hmm. So, like, you'll be writing things in Sharpie, you'll be tearing up cards and throwing them away, you'll be adding stickers to stuff. But it has a campaign, and we started the campaign early 2019.
I think if we didn't start it early 2019, we may have started it late 2018.
Really? Because I thought I got it for Christmas 2018.
Christmas, there was maybe time to...
Either way,
in 2018. Anyways, we published our first part of this two-part episode January 19th of 2019. So it's been over a year since we've talked about Betrayal Legacy on this podcast, and that's just because it's taken that long for us to get through the campaign and then find some time to record our thoughts about it and share them with you.
Yeah.
And so we finished the campaign. All 12, is it 12 sessions plus a prologue for a total of 13 sessions? We have our thoughts on the game. Matthew, I'm sure you really enjoyed it. You've mentioned even before we finished it that it was contending for one of your favorite games of all time.
Yeah, and I still pretty firmly feel that way. It's definitely one of my favorite games of all time. It's definitely had my favorite gameplay session I've ever been in, of like a board game.
So do you want to try and spend... like as much as we can here at the top of the episode, not giving away any major story spoilers so we can talk about the game to an audience that might not want things spoiled to them, and then just kind of like open the floodgates a little bit later.
Sure. Yeah. Let's try and start with a spoiler free opening section.
Okay. So, to start, first of all, this is Betrayal Legacy based on Betrayal at House on the Hill. Matthew, why don't you give us the credits for these games?
Right,
do you have those for us?
Betrayal Legacy was designed by Rob Davio, Noah Cohen, Ryan Miller, Brian Neff, Andrew Veen, and J.R. Honeycutt, and published in 2018 by Avalon Hill.
All right, and I believe Betrayal at House on the Hill was published sometime in the late 2000s by... who was that by? Wizards of the Coast?
Avalon Hill, which is owned Avalon by Hill Wizards of the Coast.
Gotcha. Designed by many of the same people. And Betrayal Legacy carries over a lot of the same mechanics and gameplay as Betrayal at House on the Hill. So just to give a short description of what a session of Betrayal Legacy is like. In Betrayal Legacy and Betrayal at House on the Hill, players cooperatively explore a haunted building, searching for mysteries and items. As you discover new rooms, you will encounter spooky events, collect helpful items, and encounter haunted omens, which are these especially spooky items that will sort of provide sometimes positive effects, sometimes drawbacks, sometimes both. And every time you encounter an omen, you do what's called a haunt check, where you will roll a number of dice, and you're trying to beat a certain number to continue cooperatively exploring the house. However, if you fail the haunt check, then the haunt begins. And typically in a game of betrayal, when the haunt begins, one of the players is revealed to have betrayed the other party members. They become the traitor. The rest of the party members become the heroes or the survivors. And one of many scenarios are then played out where the betrayer and a number of supernatural threats threaten to... destroy or eliminate the survivors / heroes, and the heroes must accomplish some strange goal, usually some kind of like ritual or objective, in order to survive and therefore win the game. Those are typical sessions But there are many different configurations that haunts can be in. So it's not necessarily always just one player is the betrayer, and they summon a couple monsters to fight the survivors. Sometimes there's multiple betrayers. Sometimes there's no betrayer and it's a purely cooperative haunt. Sometimes it starts out there's no betrayers, but then slowly people start turning to the other side. But that's just the gist of the game. And Betrayal Legacy is very similar in many ways. And you experience sort of the same gameplay loop every time you sit down for a session. But then legacy elements start to get added to the game, and these will affect how your current session is going as well as future sessions. So let's talk about a little bit more in detail about what the legacy elements of Betrayal Legacy are.
Right. The most obvious thing is that not every omen is in the game at the start of the campaign. Every time you play, normally for like regular Betrayal, you have a deck of omen cards that get shuffled. And when you find an omen, you just draw the top card of that deck. But the way the campaign of Betrayal Legacy is structured is every session will have a given omen at the end of it that is revealed after all the other omens are used up.
Right. It's sort of like every session introduces a new omen to the game. And then that omen will stick around in future sessions, but it's introduced. And it's also sort of the catalyst for the haunt in every session. So every haunt in every session you play will be sort of themed around the omen for that session. But there's multiple different haunts that could be played out in any given game of a Betrayal Legacy in any given session. And they're determined by where the omen was found, like what room of the house the omen was found in, similar to Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Right. Another major way.
Similarly, the item deck, the event deck, and the room tiles, they start very small, and then they are contributed to every session. New rooms are added to the house, new items are added to the item deck, and new events are added to the event deck. But these things could also be removed potentially.
Yeah. Or destroyed.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's an important distinction in this game between, burying something, which is to put it in the, like underneath the, box insert. So it's still intact, but it is not like something you can easily pull out of the box whenever you need to. Versus destroying something, which means to permanently destroy it, like if it's a card or a tile from a board, rip it in half. Okay, so some of the decks and stacks of tiles start small and they get added to, but then the things in those decks could also be altered in different ways.
Right. One of the main ones that happens is the items all have a sort of blank space, and then there's places where these stickers can go. And what it is the first time, when you draw an item card during a session, you can make it an heirloom, where you get to name the item a special name, like Grandpappy's famous rake, instead of just a regular rake. Or, you know, my father's weird wooden leg, I don't know. But so, you get to name it, you put a sticker on it that shows it's your family heirloom, and then it provides you special bonuses for that session and every future session. Mm-hmm. It should be noted that each session is supposed to be a new generation of a family line. So
right.
It's like,
so
these are items that are passed down from generation.
And we can get a little bit more into detail into that in one sec, but I do want to also mention that, I mean, boxes, there's sometimes check boxes on cards. For example, one card might have a number of outcomes that you have to get after you draw it. This is probably like an event card, and when you encounter it, there's a number of outcomes from the event, every outcome can only be taken once, and you keep track of that with these check boxes that you write on in permanent marker. So you'll check off one of the things, and now if that event is encountered in a future session, another player could not choose the same thing that you chose.
Right.
On the tiles, the room tiles that make up the house, a couple common things that can happen is, first of all, there's ghosts.
Okay, hold on. That's a spoiler.
I don't think so.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's a spoiler from the first session.
Yeah.
We probably talked about this in the first, I mean, it's the first session. Like,
okay, fine. Okay.
I don't think it's super spoilery to just say that there's a mechanic called ghosts.
Okay.
Fine. And that's just whenever a player character dies on a tile in this game, then you add a sticker to the corner of the room that they died in. And that is a ghost sticker. And the ghost stickers will have influence on different things in the game. But in general, it's just another like permanent way that you alter the game. The other thing is secret passages. There's just a generic secret passage sticker that sometimes will get applied to a room that'll let you transport from that room to another room with a secret passage sticker or symbol on it. Some rooms just come with secret passages already on them.
Right.
Obstacles too, I guess, are another common sticker that get put on rooms. Sometimes you'll add an obstacle, which just makes it harder to traverse the room.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the player placards.
Right. So, in regular Betrayal, you would choose a character every session, but at the start of the campaign for Betrayal Legacy, you choose one of these, family crest placards or tableaus to, stick with you for the entire campaign.
Right. So in Betrayal at House on the Hill, there's a number of characters. There's like, what, 10 characters or 12 characters, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, 12 characters. And each character has a different stat block. So they start with different stats. Of course, the stats in Betrayal and Betrayal Legacy are the same. They're strength, speed, might, speed, sanity, and intelligence.
Knowledge, I think.
Knowledge. Knowledge, sanity, might, and speed are the four stats, and they carry over in both games. And in Betrayal at House on the Hill, each character started with different stats, and as they gained and lost stats, their stat changes would be different. So sometimes a player would gain two stats from just boosting their stat by one stage. Other times players wouldn't gain any or see any change from boosting their stats by one stage. They'd have to boost it by multiple. So in this game, similarly, each player tableau has different stat lines and stat blocks, and each player will start with different stats, and their stats grow and decay in different rates. But in this game, you choose your tableau at the start of the campaign, and then you get that tableau for the rest of the campaign.
Right. And there are five of these, and each one has their own differences between them.
Right. The common thing is that there are two characters that are generally better with the physical traits that are might and speed. One of them is sort of like specialized in might and the other is specialized in speed. There are two tableaus that are specialized in the knowledge or the mental traits. So one player has a good knowledge and a decent sanity and the other has a good sanity and a decent knowledge. And then there is a fifth player that's sort of like an all around solid character. All of their stats start average and have an average growth to them.
Right.
When we played, we chose the four specialist player placards. We left that jack of all trades placard in the box and didn't use it for the campaign.
Right. So, yeah, when you get these, you write down your family name on the front. And then on the back, there is a chart that shows like every date that the sessions are supposed to take place
in this fictional world.
Yeah, I think the final one's on 2012, and I don't remember when the first one starts.
No, the first one is 1666, and the final one is 2004.
2004, okay.
Yeah, right. That would be kind of funny if it was 2012, but yeah.
Yeah.
It goes, so the campaign spans in this fictional alternate reality from 1666 to 2004, and there's 13 lines of this chart for you to fill in your information every session.
Right. And so at the start of each session, you write down your character's name for that session. And then at the end of it, you write down their fate, which is like whether or not they died or survived, as well as if they were the traitor or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it's not really a spoiler, but like sometimes your fate is a little ambiguous, especially like whether or not you are the traitor.
Yeah.
At least I have some maybes and some ellipses in that column for some of my characters that I played as. And like we said, it spans, you know, so many hundred years like near 340 years almost. And every line is typically going to be a new like descendant of this family that you've have come up with a name for at the start of the campaign. But some of the dates are close enough that you could feasibly have the same character twice. So yeah, that's just a small detail in this game.
Yeah.
Some of the dates of these, cause every session is a specific year or it takes place on a specific year.
Right.
Let's see. It's important, I think, to point out, comparing this legacy game to other legacy games, that your character's sort of starting stats and equipment are the same for every session of the game. It's a little bit common, like in Pandemic or in Charterstone, for your like your starting condition to improve as you play through the game. So like the player that you start as in the you know, the third session will have a little bit better of a position than the player that you started as in the very first session. Maybe they have like an extra item that they start with or boosted stats. In this game, that does not change from session to session. Your player for the final session starts with the exact same stats that they started with in the early session, and they don't change, at least as far as we know. Who knows if we managed to evade some kind of element in the game that would have permanently changed, but I assume that you don't permanently change them. Probably because if you only play with a certain number of players, not the max number, which is five, we played with four. Now that the campaign's over, this is a functional board game that we could play again, just with all the pieces that we've accumulated and modified over the sessions. And that fifth character is in just the same spot as the four characters that we played with.
Yeah.
But I think that is an interesting distinction between this game and and other legacy games.
Yeah,
it also kind of makes sense flavorfully being a horror game. You're not really supposed to be like a big strong hero that grows and grows and becomes more and more powerful. You're just kind of always this like average human being every time.
Yeah, and it's also that since you're playing as different generations for most of the game, you know, it wouldn't make sense for like the stats themselves to carry over that much.
Maybe, but you know, maybe the heirlooms could have been you know, handed down.
I mean,
some sessions it might have made sense if they're close enough in time that it could be the same character twice in a row.
Sure. All right. Let's see. Is there any other like core gameplay stuff?
Let's see. There's lots of naming.
Oh, yeah.
In this game, which from like a designer perspective, this is like the easiest way to get players invested in a game. This may have been something we pointed out in our first discussion on Betrayal, but like it takes like no effort at all to just remove parts or whole names of things from the game and then give the players the option to name them. In right. Charterstone, which is another legacy game that we covered in two parts, you really only get to name your character and a couple other. There's like this certain character type card that you collect a couple of over the course of the game. But in this game, you get to name lots of stuff.
Yeah. You get to name.
You get to name
your character like
that you come across.
Items.
Yeah. And your character every session, you get to come up with a new name if you like.
Yeah.
And I did like. Let's see. Again, there's a variety of haunt formats. I won't go into specifics to avoid any spoilers, but I'll just say that like over our play session, we encountered a lot of different haunt configurations. And I think that was by design, so that every session we weren't just encountering the same type of haunt where there was one traitor and three, in our case, survivors and a monster, which was good to have that variety. And also, I think good to like build into the narrative of the game that you can... you'll sometimes have the traditional ones and you'll sometimes have more unique ones.
Oh yeah. Another important distinction between Legacy and Betrayal Vanilla is that Betrayal Legacy has an outside area. So in regular Betrayal, there's three floors to the house, the basement, ground floor, and upper floor. And when you look for, or when you explore a new room, you have to keep going through the stack of tiles until you find one matching the floor you're on. And so Betrayal Legacy also adds the outside area, which acts mechanically as another floor with its own tiles you can place on it.
And as you go through the game, you'll find certain tiles in all the other zones. I think they're called zones in this game.
Yeah.
Outside, upper, basement, and ground. That will sort of make things adjacent to the outside. It seems like the outside connects with all other three areas in more ways than the other areas connect with themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, like there's the porch that connects the outside and the ground floor.
There's like underground caves that will connect the outside to the underground or the basement.
And there's a balcony that connects the upper floor to the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
The original game had an expansion called Widow's Walk that added an upper floor.
Oh, yeah.
To the game. I think the outside is a little bit more of an elegant addition to the game. And it also kind of like answers the question of like, why don't we just leave the house?
Yeah.
It's like, well, now outside of the house is also a threatening place to be.
Right. And it becomes relevant for many haunts.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I don't really have anything else that's not necessarily spoilery.
All right. So we've gotten this far without spoiling any major story elements. But again, this is part two of our Betrayal Legacy discussion. If you want to hear more thoughts on the game with fewer spoilers, then you can check out our part one, where we'll discuss. Again, we'll go into similar details on the legacy elements of this game, the design of the game, and a couple of the early sessions. I think we detail some of the things there, so there's some slight spoilers, but not any major spoilers. But from here on out, we are going to open the spoiler floodgates. So for those of you who don't want to be spoiled, tread lightly, or possibly just switch over to our early episode and listen to that if you're interested in playing this game yourself. But anyways, spoiler free. Time has ended, and we are entering the spoil zone.
The spoil zone. Okay, so yeah, the first big thing I want to say is I love how this game calls back to the regular Betrayal multiple times.
Yeah, it was very smart of this game. Wait, hold on. Was the original Betrayal released in 2004? Because that's the last session.
Yeah, give me 1 second.
I got it. Okay. Betrayal at House on the Hill, Board Game Geek, released in, it's got to be 2004, right? Exactly, 2004. Yeah. Okay. So
yeah.
This whole game is sort of a prequel to Betrayal at House on the Hill. And throughout the campaign, you will encounter, by your actions, the elements from the original game.
Right. Like, one thing is that at the start of Betrayal Legacy, you can access the basement through the basement stairs, but after some, notably terrible stuff happens from the basement gets sealed up, which is why in the original Betrayal, you couldn't go downstairs to the basement.
That's right, yeah. You had to, like, fall down. And in this game, in our playthrough, I think what happened was, like, we had to go through a portal in hell, and we became, like, servants to some dark entity that ended up being the big, bad, evil thing.
I don't know if we became servants. I think it was ambiguous what our fate was.
Yeah, we trapped ourselves in the portal, like, with the... Or maybe we didn't. Maybe we tried to seal the portal, but somebody had to stay back. Something like that. I think I have on my own player card... for our fate, let's see. Wasn't the reflection one. I'm gonna have to look a little close to see which one this was.
Right.
I remember. So it happened in 1890 in the session. I have for my character's fate lost, and under died, I wrote ..
I think the game told you to put lost as the fate.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, also, there's the mundane elevator, which you find, I think, shortly after that session.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a choice to make it the mystic elevator later in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the icing on the cake is the final story passage in the book that has all, like, the flavor text and storytelling It ends with the characters from Betrayal walking up to the door of the house.
Right.
You hear the like father, priest, whatever, talking to Ox Bellows.
Mm-hmm.
Is one part of it I remember.
Yeah, the little boy and the girl, or like one of the little boys and one of the little girls, are getting like taken out of the car by one of the, I don't know, one of the other people in the game. But yeah, all the characters are called back to like, or described as like approaching this house. I think like it literally the instant that the game's story ends, the legacy story ends, is like when the new people have just shown up to investigate this house.
Yeah, I think for one thing, it's really really clever in just calling back to the original game in the first place. It's kind of like Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But also it does give a weird sense of ownership of the original game. Like, you know, like, I was the reason why the elevator is the Mystic Elevator. Mm-hmm. Or it's kind of like an origin story.
We decided to make the Mystic Elevator, so. I like that. I like the origin story or the mythology. It's kind of like there's all these weird things in Betrayal at House on the Hill that are just, you just kind of say like, oh yeah, because it's a haunted house, of course, there's a weird thing here. But it's really cool to see like, oh, that's why the weird thing is in the house.
Yeah.
One of the cooler things I remember being was, there was a haunt where we were besieged by like clones of ourselves from the mirror dimension, like a dimension on the other side of the mirror. And for that haunt, the mirror people were abducting us, and taking us to the mirror world and replacing us in the real world. And that whole haunt, like it was a pretty creative haunt. It was a haunt in a different format where there was one betrayer who happened to be like their mirror self who had already come to our world. And they went and one by one abducted us and replaced us to make us betrayers. So it was like one betrayer and then eventually many betrayers. But in addition to that being a very creative haunt, it also explained one of the cards in Betrayal at House on the Hill, where you see in the mirror somebody write a note, this will help, take this, and you get an item card from it.
Yeah.
And you sort of like, so you just kind of see the origin story. And like in this example, sometimes that origin story is like this whole haunt, like this whole thing that you go through.
Right.
This whole experience.
Yeah, or there's another haunt with a giant like porcelain doll, I think it was, that was eating something. And eventually it got so big that it fell through the floor, and that's how the collapsed room was added.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just there's a lot of these things where like they use the base game to call back to the original game, or they use the legacy game to call back to the original game with like, you know, this is how it happened, you had a part in this.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool.
It was also very cool, since we're going full spoiler, that there were three items, specifically items in the original game, that weren't necessarily items. Actually, I think they were in the Omen deck specifically, but they weren't actually objects. There was a girl, there was a deranged old man, and there was a dog. And at least two of those... this game, the original game didn't have these like NPC characters, the inhabitants of the house. Betrayal Legacy does, and they sort of cycle through different inhabitants as you go through the sessions. But the inhabitants for the last session are the girl, the old man, and the dog. And at least the girl and the old man have like a very important story implications to them. I thought that was very cool. Like, especially, I actually didn't see it coming, but. Until all three had been assembled. But that was a very fun surprise where I was like, oh, this ghost girl who's been giving us hints of how to finish the story, she's the girl from Betrayal. And oh yeah, and this guy who's like this undying or this immortal like beast hunter who's gone mad over the times, he's the madman, and there's the dog.
Yeah. Especially because like it establishes pretty early on that the inhabitants are a man, a woman, and an animal. But yeah, I never made that connection until that game,
mm-hmm.
which is really cool.
Oh, right. Yeah, because although to be fair, it was a little hard to see coming because all the people had been adults until that point, and then the woman, they, so to represent them, they have these tokens, and then there's the symbol on the token is also on the card back for the inhabitant. But there's, yeah, there's a male inhabitant, a female inhabitant, and a dog or a pet animal of sorts. Sometimes it's a monkey, sometimes it's whatever. Yeah, so I didn't see that coming, especially because it was all adults that those things were being represented, or that were those things were representing, until that very last session when everything came together.
Speaking of coming together, I did like that there were a lot of haunts that actually were relevant to the final story once you piece all the pieces together. So the second or third haunt was a brooch, and at least for us, it was a brooch that had the spirit of a dead Viking. And it's brought up multiple times that Vikings came to this land, mm-hmm. and that's who used to live on these grounds. And then you learn in, I guess we should, might as well spoil it, in the final session that you're fighting Fenrir, which is a Norse thing,
mm-hmm.
a Norse character,
mythological
creature. Entity. But and so it kind of ties all together. And what's funny is there's a wolf on, I think, the cover of the game on the box. And I never even thought that would be anything more than just wolf, spooky, howl at mm-hmm. the moon, but it actually ended up being the villain of the whole thing, which is really funny.
And there's a spooky girl on the box.
Yeah.
And you think obviously the spooky girl is one of the threats that we might come across, but she ended up being the thing that helped us win.
Yeah.
The thing with the crucial information that that we needed to win the game.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
So this game, it's first of all, it's a horror legacy game. Obviously there had to be some twists in the narrative of the game, and that meant that there had to be a narrative to the game,
mm-hmm.
Which legacy games, obviously there's going to be a little bit of a running story. There's a reason why you keep coming back to it and playing new chapters of it, but I think this game more than a couple other legacy games actually really had to focus on that story, and it ended up being executed pretty well in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then the twist, there's a couple twists, but the main one I think is when you figure out that the characters that you're playing for the first, I would say half, it's about half, it's a little more than the first more than half of the game, before 1890, when your characters get lost, they're slowly descending into madness, in a way, or they're sort of doomed, in a way, and the twist at the end of that session is that they're lost forever, and then you start playing with new character figures, and you realize that this thing that you've been worshiping, the helm, is actually a bad thing.
Yeah So
I suppose we should talk about the helm.
Oh yeah, so the helm is this misshapen cutout piece,
mm-hmm. disc,
sort of a disc,
about 7 inches in diameter.
Yeah, I always thought it looked like a tree stump, but that might just be me. The helm,
I thought it looked like it was made of parchment or leather, which sure. ended up being exactly what it was, leather.
Yeah.
Or a leathery thing.
So the helm is laid out in, there are a number of columns, each with 3 spaces for you to put a family crest sticker. And then there are also these symbols on each column. There's one per column, and these are the runes that appear throughout the game.
Another kind of hint at the Norse mythological aspect of this game.
Yeah. So the game tells you to respect the helm and treat it properly and to fear it or something.
It's it sort of hints that if you don't respect the helm, then you will have bad luck. And yeah. and by respecting the helm, that means that you only touch it by the edges. You don't touch its front or back unless you're placing a sticker on it, which is a mechanic of the helm.
And you have and to then say magic words.
You have to come up with a chant that you say every time you take it out of the box or put it back into the box, that you have to chant as a group.
Yeah.
And the game, yeah, it mentions that like you'll get good luck or something if you respect the helm. And obviously this is a game component. And there's no like umpire to make sure that we're respecting the helm, but just to play along and out of like a little bit of superstition, our play group actually, you know, listened to what the game had to say, and we came up with a silly thing to chant every time we pulled the helm out, and we held it by the sides and everything. So it was very funny when it told us to start disrespecting the helm, because it revealed that it was actually a bad thing.
Yeah. And throughout the game, you put your stickers on the helm because it lets you reroll dice. So, you know, if you get a bad roll, there's a thing where you can just reroll it and put your sticker on it. But then it starts judging players that have used the reroll, where it will randomly determine a column and then a sticker on that column, and whatever player that is gets some outcome. But the judgments are, you know, they can be mixed. They're either good or bad. They're not one or the other all the time.
Right. There is one session of the game, I think, right before you start to expect it. Usually you're limited to one reroll per session, so you can only put one sticker on it any given session. But then the final session, you can do it like once per turn, as many times as you want.
Yeah.
So and that ended up with us filling out the helm. And when you fill out a column of the helm, it does give you a little bit of story exposition, and it gives you a huge stat boost every time you fill out a column. So it kind of led to us like wanting to fill out this column, but then that made us more likely to get judged in future sessions. And I believe I want to say that like the judgments started out as a pretty good thing, but then like in later sessions, they're mostly a bad thing.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Which if that's how it was designed, which that's the way it felt to me, then that's a pretty smart decision to make the helm seem cool and then give you free reign with the helm and then punish you for doing so because the helm is actually bad. And as you learn in the end of the game, it's sort of like a Beowulf type myth where Fenrir had like a portion of his pelt removed by a weapon, exposing a weak spot. And that portion of removed flesh is the helm.
Yeah. So the one of the like biggest strengths of this game is its usage of tone and atmosphere. And this is the perfect example of like one of the themes throughout the game is how choices done early on, you won't have full understanding of the outcome of the choice or the consequences. And you're supposed to use your best judgment, but then like it has big ramifications going down the line. So like, you know, this is sort of a typical horror trope, I feel like, is not having the full context of what you're doing. You know, messing with things you don't understand, sort of. So it uses that trope, but then like, it combines that with not telling you mechanically what exactly what you're doing is for. You know, usually in board games, you want to have the full understanding of what your choices will do so that you can make an educated choice and feel good about it. But I think the mix of the horror theme and the legacy concept of like, you know, that there's going to be things revealed later kind of helps excuse it and make it more exciting to do something that you're not sure about. That's how it was for me, at least. It's like most games that I play, I want to know what my decision is going to do, but in Betrayal Legacy I was okay with it because I figured like, you know, it'll happen eventually or it'll do something, but it's a legacy game, so I might not see what it does now.
Sure. It also helps that like usually these types of decisions don't affect the current session. They'll affect a future session, and you know they also might have the potential to affect anybody, not just you. And it's a cooperative game, so that's not terrible.
And that also fits with like another common horror theme of like things getting passed down from generation, or like decisions made in one generation affecting the future, in the future, in the far off future. And that's represented by, you know, like the helm judging is good in the moment, but it can be pretty bad later on. Or even just the fact that like When people die, they leave ghosts on the ground or on that room, and then a whole bunch of omens are related to how many ghosts are on the tile you're on. And mm-hmm. so, like just dying or killing somebody can have big ramifications for a later session that you won't quite piece together until then.
Yeah, it could make or break the difference between the survivors winning or losing.
Yeah. Which I think is a really interesting theme to play with in a legacy game.
A similar common element of horror, or maybe not a common element of horror per se, but a common element in this game that comes up a number of times is that the game lies to you.
Yeah.
It plays with your expectations, or it says one thing and then does another thing, which is kind of a horror element. But in this game, it's just straight up like the game lies to you. So, for example, in an early session, in the first session of the game, you're just straight up lied to for the haunt, where everyone is told that there is going to be one betrayer amongst them. It's a hidden betrayer setup. Which is one of the setups that you could possibly encounter in the original game. And then it's revealed at the end of that session that no one was the betrayer, and you guys just killed each other, you know, just because the game told you to.
Yeah, because of superstition.
Yeah, because of superstition. Also, the game flavorfully explains it by saying you were, like, overcome by this kind of, like, inert rage and madness that is, like, part of the land here. In around this house, which did end up making a little bit of sense with this whole like berserker, like Viking type deal going on with the story. But then, I mean, the similar thing happens again when you are the helm, and then you eventually find out that the helm is bad. Like the game tells you the helm is good, respect the helm, and then it tells you later, oh yeah, the game was lying. The helm is bad, disrespect the helm.
Yeah. That brings me to a point. I want to mention my absolute favorite haunt throughout the entire session.
Okay.
Which was the Angels and Demons haunt. So the premise for this haunt was that at this point in the story, the house had been converted into a mental asylum.
This is actually the very first haunt after your players get lost.
Yeah. This is like far into the future. So it gets mm-hmm. turned into a mental asylum. And during the haunt, the survivors are told that there's, like, demons in the mental asylum, and they have to exorcise the demons.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, like, they're carrying around a portrait that's supposed to have the spirit of, like, an angel in it or something. I say or something because I was the traitor. I was a, like, a nurse or a doctor at the mental asylum, and it just said, like, the other survivors are confused. They have delusions that there are demons. They mm-hmm. need to be medicated. And so through the session, the survivors wanted to have their sanity low, and me, the traitor, had to raise their sanity. And like throughout the entire game, you know, the entire campaign, having a high sanity is a good thing, except for this one session where the traitor or the survivors say that or hear that it's not a good thing.
Right, so I was a survivor in this situation, in this haunt, and yeah, the book. So the way it's similar to Betrayal, like Betrayal at House on the Hill, where the two sides will be given a different rule book that'll explain like what they know going into the haunt and how they win, and give like subtle hints at how the other player wins. And going into this game, the it didn't say anything about any kind of orderlies or nurses. It spoke very plainly that that we are facing demons, and the demons wanted to I think they wanted to like convert us to their side or make us like their servants, something along those lines. The demons wanted to, they didn't want to kill us, they wanted to recruit us, I believe. And so that's sort of how it explained why the demons were making us more sane, and why it, and there was some kind of explanation as to why we wanted to stay less sane. Yeah. And we just kind of went with it and believed it and played with it. And then like, I think it was midway through that haunt when we realized like when the demons caught us, like they don't hurt us. And when we attack them and fail the attack, normally you take counterattack damage, but in this haunt, you don't. And it took us till about halfway through the duration of that haunt to realize that the demons were in fact orderlies. We didn't actually know that for a fact, but we could tell, like, oh, we're probably just insane.
Yeah.
And after we discovered that, we decided to play it out anyways, because we got into the character of being insane.
Yeah.
And we just continue to willfully ignore the fact that these were not demons.
Yeah. So that's like a great example of the game lying, is the survivor's manual and the traitor's tome had completely different scenarios playing out in the same, you know, scenario. But also it's a great example of how, like, this game does a really good job at encouraging players to role play out scenarios just by, like, mechanically giving them reasons to. So, like, you know, it's one thing to ask a player to, you know, role play as an insane person. You know, how would you do that? But instead, this game just says, you are an insane person. Here's the, or not even that, it just says, like, here's mechanics to follow for this session. They're not quite the same as your normal mechanics. But then, like, the scenario plays out because of those, and it kind of, like I said, forces you to role play a specific way.
Another important difference between this, normally when it's like survivors versus something supernatural, you don't kill the supernatural thing. You just stun it when you defeat it in combat. So it's out of commission for a turn, and then it comes back to consciousness and goes after you more. But in this specific scenario, you did kill the monsters permanently. So yeah. They were mortal. And that was another clue as to, like, oh, but these aren't actually demons.
Yeah. It played with the like convention set up by the game just to kind of paint this scenario, this scene.
One thing I do want to mention is that, oh wait, do you have more to say on that?
I was also going to say, I mentioned this in the first episode, but there's also instances where you can do something for fun that gives you a mechanical bonus. Like that Viking Berserker Brooch of Rage haunt, it had the rule that when you attack, you can let out a bloody roar to roll extra attack dice. And so, you know, I was the traitor for that, so I actually, you know, just let out a roar to roll it, which put me into that Berserker spirit mindset thing. But, like, it gave me a reason to, which was fun.
So I would like to point out, let's see. One thing I'd like to point out is that as the years go by and you play these sessions, the haunts that you encounter are sort of appropriate for the year. Not just like this haunt could take place during this year, but more like this haunt is like a thing that people of this era may have been afraid of.
Oh, yeah.
Commonly, like, this is the kind of horror the people of this era may have been concerned with. So, like, for example, the very first one, 1666, just plays off like kind of the general horror or the general paranoia that may have been like attributed to like Salem witch trials, which I guess were probably later than that. But just the general like paranoia of other people and the dark arts.
That sort of Puritanism.
Let's era. See. What are.
Or
let's see, for
the alien is in what, like the 70s?
Yes,
because there is an alien.
The alien is in 1969. There's an alien related haunt.
So yeah, that's perfectly timed for that type of stuff.
I guess 1925 is the Eldritch Horror haunt we encounter. Right. So that's a little late, I think. Oh, maybe not. Actually, I'm not exactly sure when Eldritch Horror was being written. I guess, I don't know, I might as well look this up, who cares.
Sure.
I got it. Yeah, so Lovecraft died in 1937, so yeah, the 1925 is about the right time for us to encounter some sort of Eldritch god in our playthrough.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very cool that, like, the horror kind of evolved through the play sessions until you got to some more modern horror. Like you said, that the aliens, like in Signs, became something in the 70s in our second to last playthrough. But then, of course, at the end, we go back to this to the thing that was the haunt in the second act of the game, which was like this Viking myth.
Well, in the final session,
weren't
the survivors like zombies?
That's true. That sort fits of
for a 2000, 21st century horror.
That's fair
as well.
I don't think they were zombies. I think they were like they're possessed, maybe, and I don't know if they were necessarily resurrected from the dead. It's hard to say because they didn't necessarily die, or were buried or anything. And I don't think they were described as like being decomposed in the game. I think they were just like the characters from a different dimension, from they've returned from hell to attack us. But I mean, that is still a little modern. I think it is also a little modern to like blend a modern horror theme like a zombie or somebody who's being controlled by another person with mythology.
Yeah, definitely.
Sort of like a hybrid.
So it's very like, I don't know, it connects things together. It plays off not just using the horror tropes to, make something that references horror tropes, but it kind of references the real world through them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I think it's really smart how the game not only paces the story, but it paces when major components are added. So, like, you start the game, and then a few sessions later, you get the helm. And then a few sessions later, you get inhabitants and more stuff like that. And, so this way, like, it keeps evolving the game at a pretty steady pace. You know, you're not getting major things every session, but you also don't have too many, like, dry spells or lulls without major improvements.
Pacing felt like a little bit of a problem in Charterstone, it felt, to compare it to another legacy game. It felt like the more like unique sessions that we played happened at the end of the game, where like the way that you play through that session was pretty different from like the common playthrough or the common session. It was good that it paced it so that you got a new thing and then you got some time to get used to it, and then you got a new thing after you had gotten used to it.
Yeah.
Definitely. Or they changed how you think about that thing in the case of like the helm. Like you get the helm in like the third or fourth session, and then you use it the way that you think you're supposed to use it, and then by like the eighth or ninth session is when they say like, oh, the helm's bad.
Yeah. There was one negative thing I have to say about the game.
Oh no. All okay. Right. What is it?
So there's an entire deck of cards that we haven't mentioned yet, which is the Otherworld cards. These are like the portal to hell. It takes you to these.
Yes, these, like, this was
strange planes of existence.
Yeah, the Otherworlds was a key component when we discovered that the helm was a bad thing and we had to go and try and kill the thing that it came from the first time around with our original set of characters. And when we say that original set of characters, we're just talking about like an original set of minifigs that we used to represent our characters that we put away and got new minifigs. Anyways, so yeah, they go through the other worlds to try and kill the thing first and realize that they can't. So the only thing they can do is seal it. And then on the last session, you go back to the other worlds and actually do kill the beast Fenrir.
Right. But I feel like except for those two sessions, the other worlds kind of weren't anything.
Yeah.
One big thing was that, so it takes moves to go through the other worlds, as in like, you get a number of moves equal to your speed plus any other bonuses at the start of your turn. And so instead of moving through the house or exploring more rooms, you would have to instead go through the other worlds. And there were a lot of other worlds that hurt you, as in, like, literally did damage to you.
Yes. I'm pretty sure the other worlds is overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah.
It's an overwhelmingly detrimental effect on your character.
Yeah. There's some cards where if you survive it, then you get, like, a special item that's really good or some sort of stat bonus. But for the most part, like, you got damage, and then you really don't want to take damage, and you're kind of, yeah, you get curses overall. And so another reason why people didn't really spend moves there is that, you know, why go to that when you can instead go through the house and either uncover more rooms so that you can just see more events and stuff, or so that you have a chance of drawing an item and making it your heirloom. Basically, like, there were so many other interesting things you could do instead of going through the other worlds that just dealt damage. And
right,
it kind of felt like it was something they needed just to, like, mechanically have a method to go into, you know, this underworld sort of thing.
And they had to make it like a deck just so that it wasn't too easy to come across the thing that you need to find in the other worlds.
Right.
Mechanically, like, it also makes sense. It's like a horror trope of, you know, it's like Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Also, not to mention, it's very hard to find a place where you can access the other worlds. There's only like a handful of tiles by the end of the game that have a portal to the other worlds in the room deck, and they're in the basement for the most part. So, like, you got to get down there, or like the one that starts with a portal on it is in the basement.
Yeah, there's events that add gates to the other worlds to cards, but like, I don't know, it felt underdeveloped, I guess. Like, there's incentives to go that they put in, but either they're not worth it, or it's too hard to do, or, like, you know, by the time we got to the haunts that required going to the other worlds, we just tried to beeline for the places we wanted for the
haunt. Like, we would wait until the very last, we'd get, like, all the supplies that we could before going into the other worlds and be prepared for it. And then when we were, we just, like, yeah, sprint through them. Like, not waste any time at the bad places. Not give them, like, a second thought. Just, like, not what we're looking for, keep going.
Yeah,
not what we're looking for, keep going. I'd be curious to see, like, if they're more utilized in haunts in future playthroughs of the game.
Yeah.
That's, like, the only way I could see them, like, being a continuous, like, valuable element in the game.
It just beyond felt,
just those two story moments.
It just felt like a waste to, like, have these things that are in a deck that you shuffle at the start of the game and put to the side of the board, but then aren't really worth going to and don't really come up that much.
Sure. I can see, like imagining designing this game, like, you invent this, you come up with this component, it makes sense for you know, flavorfully, it makes sense in, like, a horror context, and also it makes for this, like, long, treacherous, like, path that you have to travel in order to get to the big bad evil thing, which is the supernatural entity. It explains that they're in this supernatural realm. You're diving into hell, which is very flavorful. So you make up this thing, you use it twice in the story in very, like, impactful, memorable ways, and then you probably have, like, a decision, like, do we let players access it on other sessions, or do we just use it these two sessions? And I guess by letting players access it on other sessions, then you say, like, oh, then it's not a wasted component. It's not like we're adding these cards that you're only going to use twice and then never again. Like, it's like a whole deck of cards. That's not nothing.
Yeah.
So I can see why, like, I can see why they made it for the story purposes, and I can see why they let you use it for the rest of the game to play, like, devil's advocate. But I agree that it's, like, it to the player on their end, it's something that they got to pull out, shuffle, and set on the board, and then say, like, I'm never going there.
Right. I do think the decision to make them cards with no, like, discernible artwork is very fitting for an other world, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they don't look like anything. You kind of have to imagine what they look like.
Exactly. They do have descriptions that have some sort of, like, visual element. Their names of the other world cards have, like objects and descriptions that make you kind of, they give you a picture, but it does make sense that it's something, like, probably so chaotic or like, unimaginably terrifying that it couldn't be depicted on the card. You just, like, you're, and maybe your character barely even understands what they're seeing when they go there.
Yeah. The coloration of the card reminds me of sort of the look that happens when you close your eyes and kind of look around a bit, and, like, light kind of flashes around your eyes. Do you know what I mean?
Kind of. It reminded me of Oblivion from Oblivion.
Yeah, that too. which are
Elder
both,
Scrolls 4.
I think, apt comparisons. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's a card is like, you know, the areas of the world are tiles. They're not cards. Cards are like either items or weird things. Mm-hmm. So it falls more into that category than the world around you.
Sure. Also, cheaper to produce.
Yeah.
For a component that isn't going to be used very often.
Definitely.
Again, I would be curious to see how often they're used in other haunts, because the haunts that you play for the story mode, I believe it mentions that like those haunts are just for the story, and then the haunts for the rest of the game are like unique to the rest of the game.
Yeah. I don't.
Oh, no. Okay. No, that's not true, because the haunts themselves have like rules that say like if you win the haunt during the game or during the story, go read this entry. If you didn't, then like game's over. Good job.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I don't have much else to talk about.
Let's see.
We've touched most of the bases I had.
Twist, origin story, hero stays the same. Yep. I have pretty much everything that I wrote down.
I did want to say the whole like crux behind these games is that with legacy games especially is like with board games, you kind of have to like agree to do what the rule book says. And I think that's why, at least like, I mean, I can speak for myself and say that I enjoyed like following along with the game as far as like the helm and stuff like that. But if at least like if you're not always somebody who does like those extra things that are out of game mechanics but still recommended by the rule book, I would recommend it, if only because like with board games, like I said, you're already agreeing to treat these components as something they're not, and it's not that hard of a stretch to go from there to say like, not only will I follow the rules for how to use these cards, but I'll follow the rules for how to act during the game, you know? And I encourage people who, like I said, don't usually do that to try it out sometime. This is definitely a game that I think was made better by our acceptance and willfulness to play along.
Right. Just like the original Betrayal, which I think like it helps to like treat it as a spooky thing, even though it's just a board game.
Yeah.
Like a board game is probably the least likely thing to scare you that can try, you know, of any like medium.
Yeah.
If you think about it, like compared to like music, video games, TV movies,
books,
art, just artwork in general. Yeah. Books.
Oh yeah. I've seen some spooky artwork.
This is a board game.
Yeah.
And so you do have to kind of get into it and just kind of play along to really get the full experience, and you greatly benefit from that in the original Betrayal just as much as you do, maybe even more so in this game.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
And so with that, that'll be the end of our episode, Betrayal Legacy Part 2. Thank you for listening. Similar episodes we talked about, obviously there's Part 1 where you can hear our thoughts at the start of the game, and we cover a couple of the same points. There may have been a couple points we make in that episode that we didn't get to in this one. You could also check out our interview with one of the designers of this game, Rob Davio, which we had a couple weeks ago, or was it last month? I think at the end of last month is when was released, where we talk about the design of many of his games, including this one. You can hear like how some of the haunts came together from the writing staff, and many other cool insights. That interview was promoting his game, Return to Dark Tower, on Kickstarter, which you could also check out if you like. Just a little free plug there. Let's see. We talked about Charterstone. We did two-part episodes for that at the start and the end of the campaign. So if you want to hear more on legacy games, you could check that out. And then also we did an episode on the original Betrayal a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Which is funny to say. So you could check that out. Or maybe that was... Yeah, that was like 2018. We did that. That does it for our episode of Betrayal Legacy. Thanks for listening. If you like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast. You can hit us up with suggestions for games to play there. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all of our episodes categorized. So if you're looking for all the ones we just mentioned or episodes on games that we haven't mentioned, You can find the tags for those episodes there, and that'll take you straight to the episode that you're looking for. And if you don't see what you're looking for, again, hit us up with that suggestion on social media at BG Bros Cast. Also at bgbcast.com, you can find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, where we sell merch with our cool logo on it. We're planning some new merch, so maybe keep an eye out there. We'll send some announcements out on social media when we possibly come out with some new designs. But be on the lookout for that. That does it for Board Game Bros plugs. So let's hear it for Matt plugs.
Well, first thing is we have a Patreon at patreon.com/bgbcast.
That is, of course,
Patreon.
This is like a pseudo Matt plug.
Yeah.
And but BG Bros plug, so, nonetheless.
If you support us on Patreon for $1 and up, you get a special shout out. Every episode will shout out, I think it's up to 3 people. And we'll do a question from one of our patrons as well. However,
it's up to us how many we shout out.
I'm just trying to remember what I said on the page. But also, sure. We don't have many patrons right now. So if you want a shout out and a question, now's the time. It's free real estate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're guaranteed to be in the next episode, most likely.
Yeah, and then also, if you support us for $5 or more, you get access to the 2 bonus episode series. There is Board Game Bros Let's Make a Game, in which I make a game on the podcast as it goes, episode by episode. You get kind of a screenshot of the whole game design process, as well as literal screenshots of the game design process on the Patreon that, you know, goes into detail about prototyping and stuff like that. And then also there is Board Game Bros The Dusty Shelf, in which I dust off a classic game that we wouldn't talk about on this main series. I just did an episode on Scrabble last week, so if you like the board game Scrabble and want some interesting history behind it or some interesting, analysis of its game design, check that out. And those release on our off weeks from our main series, so next week will be another, or no, next week is the first week of March, so it's the second and fourth week of every month, let me put it like that. And then, so Matt plugs, I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream Monday, Wednesday, Friday from about 12:30 p.m. Central Time to 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream roguelites, platformers, exploration games, fighting games, platform fighters, exploration platformers, you name it. I stream a lot of stuff. I've been streaming a lot of Rivals of Aether and Slay the Spire. You can follow me on Twitch for updates on when I go live. You can also find a Discord server through that Twitch page where you can talk to me and Jeff and other fans of our work. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming to get updates on when I go live as well through there.
I also stream. You can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That's twitch.tv/radical, H-A-W-K-Z is how you spell hawks, one word. I stream on Wednesdays. I mostly stream Dark Souls, but I recently streamed Pokemon. That was a lot of fun. And I might stream design work because I am a graphic designer in real life. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Design to hear my thoughts and find out when I go live on Twitch.
And with that, we will see you next week.
That does it for Matt and Jeff plugs. That does it for our episode. See you, not next week. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
No, next week.
Within another next week. Why?
Next week's the first week in March.
Okay, but this is the episode for the first week in March because it's coming out a day before the first. We'll talk about this.
No, this is the 29th. This is okay. Goodbye.
Okay. Yeah. Take it easy. We'll see you next week, maybe.